and lengthy presentation of the afternoon, I'd like to introduce David Hamilton, who assures me he is not the sound of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And he will make the further introductions.
They've given to us in concert in the Opera House through the years. So the title of this symposium is Recording Opera in New York and Rome. RCA first started recording opera in 1950, and not until 1954 did we first go to Rome for Puccini's Manolesco with Robert and Licia Albanese and Jussi Björling. Then after that, every year we went to Rome, except in 1958. And that was the year we took a sabbatical. But I would like to ask all of you, there is this standard cliche, or perhaps it's true, that actual performances of opera taken off the air, or an actual performance, are more exciting than studio recorded operas. Now, what do you think? What are the pros and what are the cons?
I think, excuse me, the, my
no,
ladies first.
Go ahead.
thank you. I think it can be more exciting. A live performance can be more exciting. But I mean, technically, I listen to, the people send me recordings of broadcasts, and I have several dozen of them. I listen to them periodically. There is a certain amount of excitement, but it's lost because you can't hear all the words. Technically, it's flaws. You hear the audience coughing and so on. It's distracting. In a way, it's exciting, but another way, I wouldn't like to own, if I was going to buy a recording of an opera, I don't think I'd buy a live performance. I prefer a studio-made performance.
What do you think, Anna?
Well, I went through several, I won't say types of recording, but I remember when I first did, I believe for RCA, my first record was Madama Butterfly, and we just performed in the Rome Opera, if I remember, with mics. When I then went from the next recordings, I remember we had all these squares on the floor and we were trying to get the atmosphere that you're talking about, Bob, in the recording, and of course stereo. And I remember how we had to walk from numbers to numbers and how distracting that was for me. And when I went to listen, I'm not so sure that I always heard moving from one mic to another. But anyway, I feel that a lot of effects we can get and emotions we can get on records sometime get lost in the theater. So I am thinking that in the long run, I agree with you, Bob, that perhaps with the results for someone who's listening all the time at home or in their cars is perhaps more perfect recorded in a studio.
Now, can you hear me?
Yes.
I hope so.
I don't totally agree. No, I don't really totally agree. I think when you get into a studio and you record an opera, cover to cover, you're very conscious that this is going on a record or tape or whatever, right? And you're trying to do the most beautiful singing of your life on that record. That is not necessarily the kind of vocal work you're doing in a performance. And there is a certain kind of excitement, and I'm talking about real excitement in a performance, that cannot come through totally when you make a recording in a studio.
But don't you think, Risa, that's because the visual is lacking? But I think you can get the excitement in the voice. The expression is the same.
You can to a certain degree, Ellie. Mm. You can to a certain degree. But I'll take my common one, if I may, because God knows Dick and I were involved in that. And I recall that I wanted to do many things that I did in my performance, right? And it sounded in that sense distorted. It didn't take on what it took on on the stage. And even Dick came to me, he said, Risa, just sing, you know, a beautiful line. My vocal teacher was always with me in my recordings at that time. And she said, I think maybe, but one thing I want, because Fritz Reiner said to me, Risa, don't scream in the last act. Don't give that, ugh, when I was trying. I said, no, I'm sorry. I am going to do it. And I did it. And believe me, that's the only thing that sounds alive to me.
Well, I agree with you, Risa, to a large extent, because any artist on stage, when you have makeup and costume and everything else, and there's a conductor in the pit, every one of your senses is keyed up, and you are listening to what you're doing, you're listening to what everyone else is doing. But on the other hand, in a recording studio, when you have to convey it all through your voice and also your mentality and your acting ability, there is the advantage that you can concentrate more on your performance, and the disadvantage that you may say, to hell with everyone else's performance.
That there I totally agree with you.
Do you remember, Dick, we did L'Amore di Tre Re?
Yes.
And the bass strangles Fiora, and it's long, no? Mm-hmm. It takes him a long time, as everybody does to die, you know, in opera. But he really, I don't think, if you remember those little very tiny gasps that people do when, you know, when you've got your hands around your neck, that would have been heard. You would have seen that she was expiring little by little. But I don't think, and I kind of thought that was very effective. And what I did was I just put my hands, you remember, I put my own hands around my neck. I didn't really squeeze, but I did get that feeling of what it would be like to suddenly have no...
Because, as you said, Risa, some of the things from your stage performance when you heard it on, say, a first take in Carmen, you didn't like. It's because singers quickly learn, as you did, that when you have a microphone in front of you in a studio, you can do things with that microphone. You can make love to the microphone.
Right.
And do subtle...
We did.
Metropolitan Opera House, or any opera house, don't travel beyond the eighth row.
Right.
So everything for recording must be scaled down and under-stressed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you can get perfection, almost, in a studio recording.
That's what you get.
You can do it over. You can do it over. You can do it a live performance. You have a frog.
Right.
I think if you did a live performance and knew that was being recorded, I don't think you would do the same as if you didn't know it was recorded. You know
well,
what I'm
saying? Well, the broadcast, I think everybody is terribly...
you're uptight.
More of, aware of a broadcast, don't you think?
But I
think
that the fact that you could do it over, you know, is marvelous.
Yeah, I still like the spontaneous.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. But technically, if people are buying and spending money for recording, I think
it's true.
I would like to.
It's
yes,
perfect stuff. Yeah.
If you could get the actual performance without.
I think it can if you have the
those
artists.
Those recordings wouldn't be going on CD. Some of them now, if they weren't, you know, pretty.
Well,
perfect.
For example, I mean, just recently the telecast of Strauss's Elektra, which I think is one of the greatest telecasts I've ever seen in my life. You know, that could come out as a record, I think, because everyone in that was perfectly cast. They sang sensationally.
Yes, but that was pre-recorded,
right.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And over and over again, too.
So I think you just proved the point.
You still have
that's right. Just proved the point.
Exactly. Right. That's
well,
exactly.
But I'm going to tell you something. The sinking wasn't quite right.
No,
but
as sinking went, it was sensational.
But right. But they brought the same, though, excitement. You can actually, being visual there, I go along with that.
The visual is very important.
The visual, along with that taping that they did, right, the pre-recording, was so electrifying.
There's another thing that enters into that discussion, you know, because when we first went to Rome, we had the Rome Opera House Orchestra there, and of course the Rome Opera House had all the standard operas in repertory. And so it wasn't a great stress for singers waiting around while a conductor rehearsed the orchestra, if it's a conductor who wasn't familiar with the orchestra and the chorus. Do you remember Maestro Ponca, the chorus director there?
I sure do.
He conducted the chorus like a prize fighter. For a pianissimo, he'd go that way, and this little sound would come out. For a fortissimo, he'd almost have a stroke. What I was going to say is when we finally moved to RC Italiano and we had the pick of freelance Italian musicians, then you had to wait an hour while the conductor rehearsed the orchestra for that segment of music to be recorded that day.
Sometime between, you know, you would sing your heart out and then you would cool off waiting for them to rehearse the next act or something. That was nuts.
And also some of the conductors, excuse the expression, were so concerned with their performance and sound of the orchestra they forgot about the singers. That's what bothered me.
It's a
human failing. It's a conductor's failing.
With the best of them. Yes. Well, without mentioning names, did any of you ever have a conductor that you were ready to assassinate?
I did.
Oh, I did.
Please go first. Tell us why. Without names.
I dare. He's dead.
No, but don't mention.
His relatives living.
His wife dies with death.
I did a recording with this gentleman of Samson Delilah. And after the recording.
Oh, no, it's not the one you think.
I did several. But at any rate, with this man, and he's a very famous conductor, an ego the likes of which one cannot elaborate more about.
Starts with the letter S. No, I'm not saying.
At any rate,
lots of conductors start with the name S.
Did the recording, and I was very pleased because I heard it in the studio. I went purposely to the studio to hear it, and I said, "Oh, that's really a yes." And you were not involved.
No, that was for
another company, right? And I said, That excitement, I like it, it's good, the balance is fabulous. And I okay it. I go home, didn't give it a second thought. About 10 days, 2 weeks later, I get the recording. It's not what I heard in the studio. So I called up the studio and I said, "This is not what I okay. What did you do with the recording?" So they said, "Oh, well, Miss Stevens, your conductor, came in and he reshuffled the sound of this recording. And then he okayed it."
Well,
did you ever speak
orchestra concert with vocal accompaniment, right?
Yes.
I had a conductor, but his first name started with S also, not the same guy. It's another S. This one has four letters in it. Oh, no, that would start with another letter. No. Anyway, they're so concerned with the sound of the orchestra that sometimes they forget that you know, we're selling the album. It's the singers that are really selling the album, not the orchestra. Oh, it's very important. We can't do it with a harmonica background. It's true. And anyway, I did a marvelous take of Cortigiani one day in the recording of Rigoletto. Dick was there, too. He was behind that glass turning, helping people turn the knobs and guiding us and telling one more take, another take, and try. Anyway, I hated him too sometimes. You know, I hated Dick more sometimes. Anyway, I did this wonderful take, and I was very, because a very difficult aria, and I was happy, went home, was having a little drink with some friends and telling them how happy I felt with this wonderful aria. About 15 minutes later, phone rings, and this conductor with name starts with S says, excuse me, Robert, do you mind to come tomorrow morning? Morning now, I've been. And re-record that because the cello player in the orchestra was not the first cellist. He was a substitute cellist. So would you mind coming back and re-recording the aria? Now, here's a man that was concerned about one of the cellists in the orchestra, not the fact that I did it. So that can happen, you see. And
was he the conductor, whose name we're not mentioning, was he thinking about the second half of the aria where there is the cello obbligato?
Had to be somewhere where the cello was. I don't know where the cello was. When I sing an aria, I have no idea where the cello is.
Was when, at the end of the kidnapping scene,
yes.
Oh, that's the...
Robert, that was when we were going through that testing phase of having a stage manager moving singers around on this charted pad. And thank the Lord, that didn't last too long.
Yes, I too think.
And so Robert was rushing off the wing, shouting, Gilda!
Gilda! Gilda mia! Gilda! And I came in wrong.
And the next thing we hear on the tape is, Gilda! Gilda! Where are you? Your mother wants you.
You know, if you'd have kept that on the recording, we'd have sold a hell of a lot of records.
So many.
Oh, dear.
Let's get away from that subject for a minute. You, unless, Anna, you have a conductor you'd like to bury.
Not really.
Not really.
I can't top Bob. I can be equal, but I can't top
it. You know, in recent years, there's been in the last year or so, there's been a lot of brouhaha and excitement over operatic artists are all of a sudden discovered as crossover artists who are recording pop tunes. You know, and everybody has written about this as though it's the second coming.
That's funny, though, because we were doing it a long time ago.
40 years.
That's right.
More than that.
All of you have done this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. We did it together.
Right. Bob has done it.
I did it. Several.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
Bob had her show. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how difficult is it for an opera singer successfully to sing, to sell pop songs, so that anyone listening to it doesn't think, oh my God, there's an opera singer trying to sing pop?
I think they have to approach it as the media it is. In other words, if you approach a pop tune like an opera singer, probably in my case, in a very high range, of course I would sound very, very operatic. I, for example, always did popular stuff in a much lower area, so I could, I don't like to use the word croon, but yes. But I was more concerned with the style of the piece than I was with my own voice. Mm. I mean, as an operatic voice.
But do you have to use a different vocal production for that entirely?
Not really. You just have to... not only scaling down, in my case, I don't know what two of you think. I just thought of having a less vibrating tone, a more fixed note, but certainly always produced as well as I could and supported. No belting, if I could help it.
In my case, I recorded and sang pop songs and show tunes before I even sang opera. I made a living singing pop songs and show tunes before I even sang opera. So it wasn't foreign to me when I finally recorded it or went into opera and went back to pop songs. I was never concerned with the voice when I sang pop songs. I was, the importance was the lyric. I didn't think vocally or technique. I didn't change the style of singing or technique of singing. I sang the way I always sang, but I was conscious of the lyric, like Frank Sinatra and people. And I listened to many of the recordings of Frank and people like that. And if you do that and concern yourself with what you're singing about, it works.
I don't want to offend you, Bob, in any way, but I would, Reza, I don't know if you think this, I think it is much easier for a man to do a crossover with a pop tune than it is for a woman, successfully.
Why?
Just because a man uses can use his, I hate to say, regular operatic style in a pop tune, his voice. I don't know if it's because it involves chest voice. I think a woman is much more easily discerned as an opera singer if she's not careful.
Reese and I made an album. I think so.
I used an entirely different kind of singing when I did pop tunes. You know that?
Yes. Right. Well, Dorothy Kirsten did too, I think. She changed her style entirely. Yes. And her production.
Yes. I mean, I did not sing pop tunes like I sing an aria. Not ever. But also, I think, and I again have to then talk about Bob, because I too grew up singing popular songs to begin with, and when I was a youngster. I mean, that's what we used to do. God, 10 years old, from 10 to 14, on the children's house, that's what we used to do. We didn't think twice about it. And I don't know, and it was a different kind of singing, and I think you don't forget that. You don't, it's sort of part of
it. It's more primitive.
You know. Primitive,
yes. More straightforward.
It is.
It's less sophisticated.
And it's less difficult.
I suppose, because it just comes naturally. Before you start having to worry about,
and you don't have to worry about high or high notes. You don't have to worry about it. And like Bob says, the voice is very important, and what you say. And it's so easy with a pop song to say something very beautiful.
Mm. Well, I can see Anna's point too, though, about a man might having less difficulty, especially if he chooses the right pop song, because in my experience, the great pop artists are those who don't have big voices, you know, and the microphone, which is always attached to them. They can whisper into that and create all sorts of magical effects. Sinatra, even in his prime, never had a big voice, but I mean, he is one of the world's great artists. And even today, when the voice isn't what it used to be, he still can create magic doing that. But a man, if you have a big voice the way you have I would think it's awfully difficult to scale down.
No, not at all.
But I don't think you have to scale down. I don't think that's...
You didn't have to scale down.
I never scaled down
at
all.
I don't think that's the approach, scaling down. I mean,
one of the biggest songs, one of the biggest recordings that ever sold for me, I mean, sold more than any aria, everything, was the Whiffenpoof song. It sold almost 1 million copies. And when I recorded it, we broadcast that on my show, and then we went to a studio and recorded. I didn't think I was an opera singer. I was thinking of Crosby. I mean, I did "We're poor little lambs who have lost our way." I didn't think resonance. "We're poor little," you know. I think "We're poor little lambs." And if I said "We're poor little lambs who have lost our way," I wouldn't have sold one record. So it's. I think it's a feel. Yeah. I think you have to have a feel for
That's
it.
Right.
Do you think when you were young and long before you ever thought of becoming stars of the opera, did any of you ever play a musical instrument?
Oh, I did. I played two.
What?
I played piano. I still play piano and viola.
She's the big musician.
Yeah.
Why did you choose viola?
I didn't. They chose me for the orchestra, and you need a lot of strength, and I was a basketball and a hockey player, and they thought I had the strongest shoulder to carry a big violin, as it were. So they really convinced me to start taking lessons, and I did, and before you knew it, I was in the orchestra.
The reason because just accidentally not long ago I discovered, and I don't know if this is true, but somebody sent in a Xerox of a clipping from a, I think, 1909 newspaper from Redondo Beach, California, a review of a concert by the Redondo Beach Band, showing a picture of Madame Ernestine Schumann-Heink playing the trumpet. And, you know, the review was very favorable. Something crazy. And I had never heard that about Schumann-Heink. I've talked to a lot of people about it, and they say it cannot be true. You know, her autobiography, everything ever written about her, never mentions her being a trumpet player.
I don't know.
I think it should. I think it makes her very simpatica. One of the boys. I think that's great.
Since then, she had the lungs for it.
She had everything else.
But did you know that Benjamin Gili played the saxophone in Beautiful?
No. Oh. Are you sure?
I've got a picture of him doing it.
Was a joke. Really, did he? No, the saxophone?
Gili and James.
He kept it well hidden.
Jazz band.
That thing.
He played saxophone.
Saxophone, yes.
I played a hell of a harmonica, I'll tell you that.
You did?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, now, let's get back to opera.
No, I'm kidding. I'd like to.
This is a stupid question which I always like to ask singers. You know, is there one role in your career that you wish you had sung and you never did?
Oh, yes. Two roles I would have loved to have sung. Tosca.
Well.
And Eva in Meistersing.
And you were a mezzo and out of that league. Why would you want to sing Eva?
I don't know. Everyone asks me that. I think...
She's almost as dumb as Elsa.
I know. But I would have made her not so dumb.
Anything would have been an improvement.
No, I think perhaps I had such an awe of Lotte Lehmann when I was a youngster. And I was in Salzburg as a student. And she was Eva at that time. And I'll never forget, I was in that performance, and either it was Toscanini or Bruno Walter, one of the two that was singing, I think it was Toscanini. And she was up there with Shore, and it was an incredible cast. And there I sat as a student, way up on the top, and she was so exquisite. And the way she did it, and her kind of parlando that she had, and that manner that she had, and I said to myself, my God, that's what I loved. And I looked at the score the next day. I knew that.
Yeah.
But it was another thing, you know. One time, look, I'll go, before you get to the other, I'll go and tell you that a very famous, even this happened with Lotte, a very famous conductor, and he shall be nameless.
Starts with S.
No, it doesn't start with an S.
Okay.
And we're in his studio. No, but Lotte Lehmann had me one time come to her ranch, her home in Ranch, the cool company something in Santa Barbara. And I went there, and Bruno Walter was there. And she said, oh, Lisa, I had such a surprise. I couldn't imagine. And he was like saying, you know, you come to this day, and she caught to me, she was a queen. Sure, I did. Walter was with him, my husband, and we went and we sat and we had lunch outside her place, and there was Bruno Walter and his wife and Thomas Mann, and we sat around, we talked, and I couldn't imagine what this was all about. And she called me inside to her room, and Meister was at the piano, and I said, what are you asking me to do? When I called him, she said, Beistro wants you to be his next Fidelio.
Up, Scheuler.
I said, Fidelio? How am I ever going to see Fidelio? Oh, she said, don't worry. He has said he'll put dir, whatever it is you can't say.
Mark it down. For Beethoven, Bruno Walter is going to do that.
And I said, the critics will kill me. And I cannot take that chance. And I will not take that chance.
You were wise.
And he was at the piano, and he was so angry with me. He was really angry with me. And, I wish to die. But I mean, it was just out of the question. How old was I? 26? Incredible.
Well, you could have sung one or two performances and hung up your shoes. You'd never sung again.
And the rest of me.
Yeah. Anna, what did you wish you had sung?
I pretty much have always sung the roles that I think I'm supposed to, but I too always wanted to sing Tosca. I think everybody does, and be.
I didn't.
At some point.
I could never sing Vissi Date lying down on the floor. I tell you that, impossible.
But it's at a certain point in my career, I did begin doing Tosca, and I'm doing it. But I think the two roles that I plan to be doing soon and that I really have always wanted to do are Adriana and Norma.
Hmm.
I think Norma is... Norma...
You one time wanted to be a mezzo.
I always wanted to be a mezzo because I adored you. I mean, it's not in the past tense. I always wanted to sing Carmen.
Certain roles?
Always. I wanted to do all the roles you did. That's a well-known story. My first teacher at Curtis Institute once said to me, "Will you stop trying to be Risa Stevens?" She said, "You're a high soprano." I said, "But I don't want to be. I want to be like Risa." And I didn't get that wish, so I stopped. But I too recorded Carmen for a movie, but that's about all.
Why do you want to do Adriana?
I just think it's a part that suits my temperament, yeah.
But all sopranos want to sing up.
Well, I didn't until I really started setting the score, yes. I think it's a great, great score.
It's a nice death scene and two nice arias.
No, it's not for the arias. I just like the part of her being this great actress, and I think it's a great acting part.
Exciting routine.
Yeah.
Yes.
But on the opposite side, that's why I like Norma. I think Norma puts together all the Traviatas I've done, all the Lucias I've done, Sonnambula, that kind of thing. I think Norma is really putting together most of the roles I've spent my career doing. So,
yes. Robert, you don't want to sing Tosca, but what do you wish you had sung?
Maybe he's thinking of Norma too, are you?
Not really. I don't like that big aria in the second act. It's tough. It's tough. I, believe it or not, it's going to surprise you. Boris Godunov.
Mm. Really?
Yes. I think I had the timbre of voice. I think I could have done it. Never got the occasion, and I didn't have the guts to ask Mr. Bing or whatever. But I was offered the performance in Newark, and I went over the score, and Maestro, and we sang it. I think I could have done it, but I didn't want to take a chance. But I'm sorry I didn't. I think I could have done a damn good Boris, believe it or not.
You probably could have.
How low does that part go?
It doesn't go that low. It's a bass baritone role.
Yeah.
It's,
as a matter of fact, it goes quite high.
It goes high. I think it's a low A or G, which I sang, and I could sing. I loved the part. I would love to have done it in Russian, because I heard Russian in my home spoken, and I had a flair for the language. And
a lot of times they didn't do things in Russian.
I would have done it in Russian. So if I made a mistake, nobody would know the difference.
It's true. A lot of times
I sang in Boris with Pinza.
Did any of you ever sing in a multilingual performance?
Oh, I did.
Fun or not?
I did. No, it's not fun at all.
Yeah, no, it isn't fun.
No.
You mean program, planned, or unplanned?
Either way.
I
planned, it might be less bad for you.
Well, may I?
Yeah.
No.
Very early in my career, I was engaged to do Mignon, the Chicago Lyric Opera, in French. And it was with Giulietta Simeonato, and the tenor was Simonon. And the bass, I can't remember, Wilderman. Anyway, as it turned out, the tenor got sick. The only person in the tenor role came and did it in Italian. The bass ended up being somebody who could only do it in German. So the next day, the Tribune wrote, "Polyglot Mignon last night." Yeah, because Simeonato at a certain point decided it would be better for her to sing with the tenor in Italian. So I was the only one that ended up singing the original French, really, which was hard. And there's a wonderful story. I don't think you know this. My entrance as Feline was decided by a great director to be with two great Danes. And boy, they were great. They were big. They were almost as tall as I and ornery. And I remember, as I'm supposed to come in, and they pulled me all the way across the stage, and I never did sing my entrance because they dragged me all the way to the other side of the stage. Yeah.
Went to the.
And so, and Feline has a reprise off stage, which I was too breathless to sing that either.
A poly what?
Polyglot.
A polyglot. He'll tell me what that means later. I was doing a performance of Balaui Mascara in San Francisco, Jan Pierce and Maria Callas, who canceled 2 days before the performance. She never left Milan. And now we're stuck. We don't have an Emilia. But there was a young lady that was singing with the company, the German opera. Now, gee, her name escaped me. She's a very famous gal. I'm embarrassed. Who sang it once in German in her career. And Steinberg was the conductor. And her husband at that time was her coach. And they went over desperately. And we didn't even have a rehearsal, as a matter of fact. But we went on. And he was prompting her in German. And we had an Italian prompter that was prompting Jan Pierce and myself. Came to that wonderful, very difficult trio. Was it the second scene in the second act?
When Amelia is discovered.
Right.
Veiled.
Right. And she's singing in German, and Jan and I in Italian. And it got very complicated. And we got mixed up, and it was just. And Jan ran over to me, and he saw this, and he says, "Bob, let's do this goddamn thing in Yiddish." And Steinberg was going.
Where are we?
We finished it. We finished the opera, and I must say it came off. But we were a little desperate for a while.
Everything must come to an end.
Yeah.
Bezos, what was your?
Well, I can't top that because it's not funny. When the war broke out, I was in South America at the Teatro Colón, and Cliver. We had a Rosenkamp we had to do, and we didn't have Sophie, and we didn't have anything. And he said to me, "What can we do?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." We had, so they had, I mean, the only one who could sing German was Liszt, this happened to be there with me at the time. And we had a French Sophie. We had a Greek, I think, who sang the funny song. We had the chorus who all sang in Spanish. I forget who the Marshallin was. I don't even remember who she was. And that's what the performance was. I mean, we just put it together.
And it went.
Well, it went. Strangely.
Somehow or other, it comes off. I don't know.
No, there it is.
Well, I have. Early in my career, gone to places where everybody sang in a language but me. I mean, I have done Traviata, I say, against everybody singing in Swedish or in Danish or in Hungarian and that is really, I guess, the test if you know an opera, because you kind of come in. It isn't enough a musical cue sometime, but it had to be. And those, I didn't have the good luck to have a prompter in Italian, just the prompter who was telling everybody else.
Yeah. Of course, Robert, you know, you have had through the years a reputation for trying to break up performances on stage. Sorry, in Aida, in the second act, when defeated Ethiopians were marched in, and at that particular time at the Old Met, the budget must have been very slim, and they had very few defeated Ethiopians. And you came.
Someone that weren't even black.
Suo Padre sang beautifully in Vinti Noi Fumo, Morten Van Cercare. Right. And then you rushed up to the Aida and said, "No wonder I lost the war. Look at my arm."
Yeah. And who was Aida? Leontine Price. And she, And she said to me, she's shown up, baby, shown up. Shown up, baby. Oh, I loved that. I loved that. We used to try to break each other up. But we finished this performance. I don't know if this one or was another one. And just a, it was a marvelous evening. And people were throwing flowers at her and her brain. And she was wonderful. And she walked over to me during all this wonderful thing that's happening to her. And she walked over to me and says, "Now, baby, you go out and try to get a taxi." I mean, out of the clear blue. She was just, I mean, sensational gal. Sensational gal, yeah.
But now, speaking of humorous things like that, what is the funniest or the most awful or the most awkward thing that ever happened to any of you on stage during a performance?
We were doing a production of Faust at the Old Met, and I was not in on all the secrets of it when it was put into production. And no one told me little things like that there was a lake, but there was no water, and the trap door for Mephistopheles was supposed to close, but sometime it didn't. So before me, people kept stepping in the lake, and I remember Siepe once stepped in it, though he mounted the production and, you know, shook off his feet when they told him he was in the middle of the pond. But no one laughed when I passed by where Mephistopheles had gone out and the trap door was left open and I fell in and kept singing. And I only had one foot in there and I could have been killed, but anyway, I managed to get out. That was seemed funny at the time.
But no one laughed?
Yeah, everybody laughed.
You kept on singing?
Yeah, that's what made him laugh, I think, that I didn't.
Well, Grease is sitting here. I could tell the story. It was really one of the funniest things, and almost tragic, but it was funny when it was finished. We're doing a new performance of Carmen, a new production of Carmen, and the dress rehearsal was wonderful. Now we're performing, and in this performance, Escamillo leaps on this little on this table, very dashingly leaps and sings the Toreador song. And there I came out and leaped on this table, and the stagehand forgot to prop it. They're on wheels, you know. And there I sang Vortretos, and I rolled off into the wings past Risa. And I'll never forget, I told the story recently on an interview, and I never forget Risa's eyes, you know, and she, was very serious, you know. And as I rolled by, she went. I did get off in time to come back and finish the aria.
No, but to get back to the Carmen, I had an awful time. I used to kiss them, really kiss them, you know.
I know.
And it happened to him, but it happened one time with George London. And we had this scene in the second act where then he grabs Carmen, you know, and he kisses her. And of course, I had such trouble with my lipstick, and it was driving me crazy that every time I came off the stage, I had lipstick from ear to ear. And I said to my husband, "I've got to find something to keep the lipstick on, that I don't go through this every single day." So my husband said, "Fine, let's go out and buy something," which we did. We went to a shop, a theatrical shop, and we bought a stuff. It was a, almost like a, it felt like
cement,
alcohol, or something like that. And you put it on, you know. And I put it on my lips before I went out for the act. And George London grabbed me and kissed me, and we couldn't get our lips apart.
Your lipstick was fine.
Yeah.
He had it too. Well, I think our time is almost up for this afternoon. And I wish we could continue, but I cannot thank you enough, Anna, Risa, and Robert. Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure to be here. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you.
I had a lot of fun. That is over.
That's right, fast.
forget that we're expected at the Museum of Broadcasting from everybody at about 6 o'clock. There's instructions on how to get there. Evening. Between 6 and 6:30.